From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I think the governor, out of his own actions, put himself here in a really a no-win situation. He clearly muddied the water by telling a group of socially conservative Republicans that he was going to veto the bill when he didn't. In our House, that's a lie. So I think his credibility really got tarnished on this.
I'm hoping somebody comes forward to run against him and that we take him out as Republicans, or I'm hoping that he decides on his own. Look, my base has eroded beneath me. There's no chance for me winning because my base is going to stay home.
I don't know. I can't predict the future, and today I'm not really focused on politics. If you just watch and see how I'm working, the one thing I can say to you is I will never give up on working to protect Illinois, create a better future for the people of Illinois.
We're just fighting among ourselves. I don't see how that makes us stronger. I don't see how that builds our base. I don't see how that allows us to enact policies that work for the benefit of all. It narrows the base in my mind.
And State Representative David Harris of Arlington Heights, he's the latest to announce he won't seek re-election to the General Assembly. 29 members now leaving or planning to leave. He's a Republican, and there are some divisions in the Republican Party. We heard from Governor Bruce Rauner there, and also State Representative Jeannie Ives speaking on WMAQ-TV, and Senator Jason Berrickman on WJBC Radio in Bloomington. Can the Republican Party stay together? We'll talk about that and more on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford. I'm joined by Charlie Wheeler. Charlie's director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Also in studio with us, Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House reporter. And joining us by phone, Greg Hines. He's a political writer, blogger, and columnist with Crane Chicago Business. And Greg, it's good to have you on once again.
My pleasure.
And Brian, I'll start with you on this one. What is going on with the Republican Party right now?
Well, they're pretty upset with the governor. At least a lot of Republicans are upset with the governor. This has been brewing for a long time. Republicans have been going along, some of them against their will, with the governor's long two-year strategy to not agree to negotiate on a budget until he had his elements of his business-friendly, union-weakening agenda passed into law. And eventually, as many as 16 Republicans voted against him, decided to break with him to help pass a budget and end that impasse. So that's kind of part of the background noise of this. Meanwhile, there were a number of contentious pieces of legislation that came out of the General Assembly this year that would be very unpopular with core Republican voters. One of them had to do with whether Illinois would become a sort of light version of a sanctuary state. It's called the Trust Act, and the governor ended up signing that. Now, obviously, law enforcement, a lot of law enforcement groups supported that as well, which he would point to. But then the governor completely upset members of his base who are very strongly anti-abortion by signing a bill that would provide for state employees and recipients of the state Medicaid services to be able to have abortions. And he had told reportedly social conservatives, he had told Cardinal Supich in Chicago that he was going to veto that portion of that legislation at least. And when he did not do so, you have Republicans talking about, as we heard Jeannie Ives at the top of the show say, hoping that he doesn't run or that he loses in the primary.
And Greg, from where I sit, it seems as though that may have been the biggest problem with this for a lot of these social conservatives is that he sort of took them by surprise because he told them one thing and did another.
Well, if American history proves anything in recent decades, it's that on abortion, doesn't matter where you are so much as you hold your position once you're there. In this case, the governor, when he was running for governor, assigned a questionnaire saying that he would favor extending Medicaid to cover abortions, or at least more than the few number that are covered now. There's people who should know tell me that was at the behest of his wife, who told him to sign it, even though his staff said stay out of this. And then he gets into this. The legislature decides to force the issue this session and presents a bill to not only guarantee abortion rights, but to extend it to Medicaid. and he tells the cardinal and lots of people in Springfield, I'm going to veto it, then everybody goes to work him on the other side, and he flips back. You don't want to do that. Whatever you manage to irritate everybody on both sides when you do that, and that, unfortunately for him, is what he's done. Now, that having been said, this whole abortion debate, as well as what happened with the budget, is part and parcel of what's happening in the Republican Party nationally. Nominally, they're in charge. They run everything in Washington. But there's divisions over how far to go. I mean, look at what happened on the health care issue. I kind of consider this to be the same kind of thing. There's some who want to take the, we want it all, we're not going to give an inch, and there's other people who want to compromise, and there's folks in between and off in different directions. And unfortunately for Mr. Rahner, as he decides to seek a new term, that's where he is. He's trying to lead a party that in many ways doesn't want to be led, and he's trying to do so inconsistently. That's a really bad mix.
And one of the weird things I thought that the governor said when he signed this legislation was that you're trying to find middle ground with people. This is not an issue you find a lot of middle ground with.
No, I mean, this is something where the polling is 45, 45, and 10, or, you know, so there's maybe 3% of people who are undecided. There is very little middle ground. I mean, he has said himself, if you really believe that, that abortion is wrong, that it's murdering, an unborn child, then it's not something that you feel like you can compromise or go meet somebody halfway on. And likewise, the other side. I mean, if you believe fundamentally that the women should have this choice, that it's, their body takes precedence, then it's not something that you want to compromise on. So this is it was a pretty, I will say, brilliant political move by the Democrats to kind of box him in. He, one way or another, he was going to irritate some major block of voters with his decision here.
And Charlie, I want to get your thoughts on this. We've seen divisions in both parties. They're always there, at least under the surface. But what is your thought on what we're hearing and seeing really bubbling up right now?
Well, I look at the abortion issue as one on which you really can't win. No matter what side you come down on, you're going to, as Brian suggested, you're going to aggravate half of the voters. And I know in my case, back in the day when I was writing stories for the Sun-Times about abortion legislation, the reaction, you would write a story and it would have the views of both sides in the story, and you get complaints from both sides because you included the other side's view, which they thought had no merit. So it's very divisive. But to me, there's another issue at work here, and that is the fact that he lied. That's something you can't do in political life with your colleagues. I mean, politicians lie to the voters all the time through their campaign ads. I mean, anybody who believes a campaign ad that a politician puts out thinks that that is gospel, they're going to be in for a rude surprise. But in dealing with each other, one political figure to another, one public official to another, the cardinal sin is lying, saying one thing and then doing something else.
But Charlie, did he lie, or do you think he came to some type of decision after all of this? And maybe he just had more time to think about it and this was the decision he felt most comfortable with.
That may be, but you don't tell somebody up front, I'm going to veto this bill, and then a matter of months later, sign it.
And why he chose to, if there was any doubt in his mind about which way he was going to go on this, why didn't he say, well, I'll take your, recommendation to veto it under advisement. I hear where you're coming from. I will really think hard about that. But, what we've heard from multiple people is that he said he would veto it.
Yeah. And that's the thing that gets me. I think if you have a position, whatever it is on the abortion issue, the other side will think you're wrong. But if you keep that position and stay steadfast with it, at least they'll respect you for having the tenacity of your convictions. But when you flip like that, and it's not an issue like some economic issue in the budget, should we use $100 million for this or should it be $150? And you say, well, I want to do $100, I'll go $150. That's really flexible. There's not that same kind of emotion involved as there is in abortion. So had he said throughout, I'm going to stick with what I said on that questionnaire that I filled out where I said I support a woman's right, and just said to the Republican lawmakers who were pressing him and others who were pressing him to veto the bill, I'm sorry, but my position is out there. I'm pro-choice. I understand where you're coming from, but on this one, we're just going to have to disagree. But he didn't do that. And part of it was he was trying to be too clever, I think. He was trying to get these Republican lawmakers to back him on the other issues that apparently to him are of greater concern than this whole right-to-life pro-choice argument.
Now, Greg, we have this situation here where the governor is, you know, we mentioned these divisions in the Republican Party, and there are people who are very upset with him. But at the end of the day, is it going to hurt him politically? It seems to me that a lot of these people, many of them, you know, so opposed to Michael Madigan and what Democrats stand for, that I would think they'd come back into the fold and still support Governor Rauner if he's running for reelection, which he apparently is.
That is a good question. The first question, though, is somebody going to pick up the challenge and run against him in the primary? Representative Ives has strongly stated that she might, but she hasn't done it yet. The longer someone waits to make a move, the more doubtful it is they're going to run, because we're already pretty far into the game here. We're well into petition season already, and people only have about another month, and it takes a lot of money and whatever. If somebody were to run against him in a primary, I think it would probably hurt him, although I have to say that former Governor Jim Edgar had opponents from the right on a couple times and managed to survive and thrive nonetheless. In the fall, I think you're onto something. There's going to be a few diehards who are going to say, hey, I'm not coming back to him. I'm gone. You broke your word. I can't trust you. But then they're going to look at the Democrat, and a lot of them, I think, we'll find out how many are going to be inclined to do what happens all the time in American politics now, which is you hold your nose and you vote anyhow. But we'll see. It's going to depend on how this plays out. It's going to depend on what kind of issues a Democratic nominee has. It's going to depend on how popular Trump is in a year. All this is still in the mix.
Before we move on to another topic, Brent, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yeah, I think Governor Rauner has been very successful at papering over some divisions in the Illinois Republican Party, and I think Greg alluded to this earlier, and Charlie did too. That, you know, you have the social conservatives where that's their key issue, and you have the economic conservatives where those are their key issues. And you know, I think about the person of Jack Roser, the late Jack Roser, Republican. I don't know what you'd call him, activist, fundraiser, kingmaker, maybe even. Maybe that's stretching it a little bit. But, you know, he had a couple of big issues, being anti-abortion was one of them. He also strongly opposed teachers' unions. And I think that he probably, as a lot of Republicans did in going with Governor Rauner in 2014, or then candidate Rauner, held their nose on some of the social issues where the governor, you know, really played that down and said he didn't have a social agenda. Maybe they imagined that the governor would be a little more with them than he was on this, but they decided that the economic issues were what they were going to go with on him on that. But there are still these divisions. I think back to Judy Bart Topinka, back when the party selected Alan Keyes to run against the very conservative out-of-stater to run against Barack Obama for the U.S. Senate back in 2004. She described the Republican Party as a circular firing squad. Governor Rauner has done a good job kind of papering over that, holding the party together, and it'll be interesting to see, and something to watch is whether those divisions, you know, continue to bubble up.
Well, the Democrats certainly see an opportunity, I'm sure, with these Republican divisions, but the Democrats have some problems of their own, especially in Cook County right now, and it really revolves around this sweetened beverage tax, which is just getting a ton of attention, so much so that I'm hearing about it in Springfield, and it only affects Cook County. Greg, I know you've been following this as well. What's the latest on this, and why is this so controversial?
Well, the latest is that Commissioner John Daley, the brother of former Mayor Richard Daley and the chairman of the Finance Committee, broke his longstanding alliance with Tony Preckwinkle during the week and announced that even though he had voted for the tax, that after listening to voters and hearing public outrage and whatever, he's now decided to vote to repeal it. Since it only passed on an 8-8 tie vote with Preckwinkle casting the tiebreaker, that means the 9 votes needed to repeal the tax are now in place. The question is whether there are 11 votes to override the veto that Preckwinkle has suggested she would make, but until she does it, you never know for sure. It's controversial because she's kind of all the tax hikes that have gone through in the Chicago area in recent years, the property taxes in the city, the bag tax, you have to pay 7 cents to cart to for a bag to cart around that liter of Coke now up here. The water and sewer tax, the sales tax increase the county had, the state's income tax, all this has kind of come down on Prager's head. Because people, when they see this, because the way this tax played out, it shows up when they go to the store, and they can see it literally right on their receipt. It's not like they have to wait when they pay their property tax twice a year. It's boom, it's right there. So you know, you go out to the corner of Walgreens or whatever to get a 99-cent liter of Coke on sale, and you get a receipt that costs you $1.85 because there's a 78-cent soda pop tax on top of it. But that's the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. People are angry. They're so angry that precinct captains up here tell me that people don't want to sign nominating petitions because Preckwinkle's name is on it. They don't like Preckwinkle. So she's got a real problem. So there's a revolt. And right now, it doesn't look like she's going to be able to stave off the revolt. Either she's going to have to cave in or she's going to lose.
Charlie, this tax, I guess, does this bode poorly for those who see maybe that the state of Illinois will need to, you know, produce other taxes? For example, if they want to do a capital plan of some sort, there needs to be a way to pay for that. In the environment we're seeing, having just raised the income tax and seeing the outcry over this, it doesn't seem like that's something that's going to get a lot of momentum.
I think the difference is with a capital plan, you can always tell your constituents, yeah, I voted to raise the gas tax by a couple pennies, but on the other hand, that road that was turned into oatmeal is now going to be fixed. Or if there's, say the last time we did one of these, we raised the tax on booze to help pay for some capital things under George Ryan. And you could go home and say, well, you know that leaky roof in the high school gym? We're going to get it fixed. And Ryan agreed to give lawmakers individually a pot of money, so-called member initiatives, that in essence they could spend on whatever they wanted in their district. And that was how he got the votes for it, and that was why lawmakers were able to sell it to their constituents, whereas something like the soda pop tax is used for much more amorphous purposes, and it's not something concrete and visible. And if there were a move for a capital plan, you would also have organized labor being for it because of the jobs. You would have the business community being for it because of the improvements to the infrastructure. So there'd be a lot of support behind that plan, and it would be a bipartisan agreement. And I think it could be done with a lot less consternation and a lot less upset than what happened with the soda pop tax.
Of course, there's always a question of trust involved, going back to your earlier point in passing a big capital bill.
Right, which is why we did not do one during Rod Blagojevich's time.
Yeah. I was struck by something that Greg said about the, you know, how you really see that money, that soda pop tax on your receipt. And I was in Chicago a few weeks ago and I bought a soda at the store. And I had exactly the moment he described where I looked at the receipt. I said, holy moly. And I kind of, if there's any social scientists listening, I think I would love to find out, you know, with the rise of direct deposit, people don't necessarily look at their pay stubs every week or every month when they come out anymore. I almost wonder if the income tax is now easier to raise without people noticing than something that hits them, like, say, every time you go to the grocery store. It's an interesting question as to – because everybody, of course, here in state government, income taxes are one of the prime things that people talk about. It was viewed as highly controversial when we passed one earlier this year. And yet we have not heard nearly as much about that from the political operatives who seem to think that this soda pop tax is a bigger winner, at least from the Republican messaging standpoint. I'm getting tons of press releases trying to tie the Democratic gubernatorial candidates to the soda pop. They're staying silent on the soda pop tax, that sort of thing, and not hearing nearly as much about the income tax increase anymore.
Well, let's talk about the possibility of jobs coming to the state if the state could land the second Amazon headquarters. And Greg, you've written quite a bit about this. They are trying to make the proposal, I guess you would say, to Amazon to say, come to Illinois, come to the Chicago area. I'm guessing the expectations are rather high for this right now.
Yeah, all the insiders in here seem to feel that Chicago really has got a strong shot at that, and I hear that from both the state and the city. And it has to do with the same reason that lots of big corporate outfits have been moving their headquarters to the city in the last few years, McDonald's and Motorola and ADM, some from the suburbs, some from other states. The reason is that if you're a big corporation now, what you need more than anything else is good talent. And good talent at this point in American society seems to want to live, at least the youngsters do, the young folks, they seem to want to live in big cities where, you know, they can go to a ball game, there's lots of bars and restaurants, it's an interesting place to live. They don't want to live out in the suburbs, at least until maybe they have kids. But the corporations are moving in search of talent. Chicago's got talent. It's got a great talent pool. It's called the Big Ten. Which supplies lots of folks that are attracted to companies like Amazon. Amazon is looking for, so that would appear to put Chicago at least into the finals. Now, what else it's going to take? How much of incentives? Whether they want to be in a warm climate, whatever, that we don't know. But the signals the company has set out is they said, "Gee, we want to be in a metropolitan area with more than 1 million people, that with an urban environment where we're real close to an airport with international air connections, and where we have the ability to tap top talent." Chicago scores well on all of those, and that's why we're in the game.
Well, the governor, of course, has talked before about the fact that he doesn't feel it's a good place to do business. And, of course, we've had, you know, corruption and all sorts of negative stories about Illinois that have made national headlines through the years. Do you think that hurts Illinois' attempt at something like this, or is Amazon just too big?
I think that the recent budget deal that was struck in Springfield is probably very helpful in helping not remove but ameliorate some of those concerns. There's corruption and there's problems almost everywhere to one extent or another, a little worse here, no question about it. But what I think Amazon wants is confidence that the government is functional, that if they need something, there's somebody there who could get it done. As long as we were at budget war in Springfield, nothing was happening. They couldn't be sure of that, but now, for good or bad, we have a budget, we have a compromise deal on education. So Rauner and Emanuel can kind of go together and wink a little bit and say, "Oh yeah, we're on the same page. Well, you know, you need us, we'll be there."
And of course, Brian, last time that this came up on the show, we talked a little bit about the fact that it would be certainly a boost for Governor Rauner running for re-election, and it would also be a boost for the embattled mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, if they could pull this thing in.
Yeah, I mean, on the surface, it looks like a big political win. You get to stand there and shake hands with Jeff Bezos, who's the darling of a lot of media coverage. Even media people seem to like him now since he bought the Washington Post. And I can't remember the last time a corporate headquarters fight got this much attention, not just in Illinois and Chicago media, but around the country. The Wall Street Journal's Mansions section had a story this morning about, you know, trying to read the tea leaves of where Jeff Bezos has property and is he going to want to locate close to one of those. Unfortunately, I don't think Chicago is at the top of that list if you favor this. I do also wonder, though, how much this is going to cost Illinois taxpayers. And we saw Wisconsin recently had a deal to bring a Foxconn factory. This is a big Chinese manufacturing company that works with Apple and a lot of other tech companies. And I've seen estimates ranging from, I think, $230,000 up to, you know, approaching $1 million per job if, you know, they bring the full number of jobs in, if the full incentives get paid out. I mean, there is this kind of, you know, there are a lot of people who, fiscal watchdog types, who raise questions about whether, you know, states and cities should be competing with each other in this way to, you know, give tax handouts to big companies.
And Wisconsin is giving Foxconn a $3 billion incentive package. And there's a lot of eyebrows raised about whether that's going to pay off too.
Well, I'll make a prediction that there's certainly going to be some incentives that Illinois and Chicago offer, but it won't be of the magnitude, at least the per-job magnitude that you were talking about with Foxconn. There's some reason to think that was maybe a little bit of an outlier. You have to pay more to get factories than headquarters. Plus, the political reality is, even if Amazon does promise 30 or 40,000 jobs, we don't have $100 billion to give them. We just don't have that kind of money to throw at it.
Couple of minutes left here in the show. And Brian, I thought, of course, the story that dominated the headlines throughout the week nationally was the shooting in Las Vegas. Anytime we see a mass shooting like this, we hear discussions, the debate over gun policy. And in Illinois, there's already been legislation filed. And what are you hearing on that?
Yeah, there was a couple of political reactions to this in Illinois. And, you know, obviously your mind first with something like this goes to the victims and the human tragedy. But since this is a political show, it's worth talking about how, you know, legislators are reacting to this, I think. And we heard out of Washington, both Republicans and Democrats saying that they wanted to take a look at these so-called bump stocks. This is a device that you can attach to the back of a semi-automatic rifle, and it makes it operate almost as a fully automatic rifle. And that's what allowed the gunman in Las Vegas to fire so rapidly. It's interesting to note that the way the Republicans want to do it is through the regulatory process. They want the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, to reevaluate a decision that said these things were not illegal from a few years ago. And they're even saying, you know, under the previous administration. So they're kind of tying it to the Obama administration. The Democrats want to pass legislation. The Senate Democrats have signed on to a bill that would outlaw these things. And they're looking at other bills. Here in Illinois, State Representative Marty Moylan, a Democrat from Des Plaines, has introduced a bill that not only would ban these bump stocks, but would also go much further. And it's basically a long list of things that gun control advocates have been pushing for a long time, banning high-capacity magazines. Most semi-automatic weapons would have to be registered and new ones could not be sold in Illinois. It's a much broader look. What I don't really have a good sense of yet is this something where there's an incident, you want to be seen as doing something, and so you put a big bill out there and, you know, you're not necessarily going to fight tooth and nail for it in the upcoming veto session? Or is this something where we could really see a real fight in the state level? I do think it's worth noting that in Illinois, both Democratic caucuses in the House and Senate have lost some of their key top pro-gun people in recent years. State Senator Gary Forby, State Representative Phelps stepped down. State Representative John Bradley was defeated. And so those caucuses are more liberal, and probably they still have majorities, and they're probably more amenable to gun regulation.
All right. Time now for our notes from the field. Charlie, let's go to you first.
Well, we've now got 3 months in of the higher income tax rates, and not surprisingly, the state's coffers are doing better. The Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability came out with its most recent update through the month of September, and it shows that our general funds, the main checkbook account, was up roughly $1.5 billion from this time a year ago, close to a 22% increase.
All right. Greg Hines?
I want to pick up on a point Brian made. Mike Madvin, by all accounts, kind of had to be talked into going along with an income tax increase. He was worried about the impact of his folks. But all this furor over the soda pop tax up in Cook County has taken the spotlight off of Madigan and put it right on that. We're not talking about your state representative voted for that terrible income tax increase. Now we're talking about Tony Preckwinkle and the income tax and the soda pop tax. Madigan ought to send her a dozen roses and send every member of the Board of Commissioners a case of scotch, because the monkey's kind of off his back, at least so far.
All right, that will do it for this week. Members of the State Week broadcast included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Greg Hines. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org. Production assistance for the program provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.